the Rexha perspective, she verdeens beat on Hello Africa. Ons pad lag op die donker kontinent. Hallo Afrika, ons vra die gehoor om op te staan. Dames en heren, die rechterhand voor die hart. Kere hoofdstuk, die hoef af en blijf staan ver die stem. Ons gast weer vanavond is meneer Peter Stiff, author of The Silent War, South African Ricci Operations, 1969 to 1994. Peter, welcome to The Right Perspective, and hello, Africa.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Okay, and could you tell us why you gave the title The Silent War, and what was South African Ricci Operations?
Well, you see, it was a silent war as far as the special forces were concerned, which was the reconnaissance commandos. You must appreciate that you know, just the name reconnaissance commandos, these were done in the days when people gave names to units which didn't suggest what they were. You know, they didn't want people to know what they were. They didn't want them to be known as special forces or whatever it was. So that's how they became the reconnaissance commandos. And with the war that South Africa was fighting, which, of course, wasn't a very popular war from the side of the world because of apartheid, but nevertheless, they were facing sort of enemies in all sorts of states, basically backed by the Russians and the Soviets and the Cubans. Best not to confuse the Russians with the Soviets or the Soviets with the Russians, because they were very different at that time. Although looking at Georgia today, you wonder if there is much difference. But anyway, there was enemies trying to bring down the South African state, and special forces were used to combat this. They were there to create guerrilla movements in other states to cause destabilization, to get the places' minds off of South Africa. And that included virtually, well, every state in Southern Africa. You must appreciate that didn't include Rhodesia, which was, at that particular time, still fighting for its life. And, of course, unlike South Africa, Rhodesia didn't have apartheid, but it didn't matter because it was white-ruled. It had to be brought down. And it became Zimbabwe, and we see the disaster, what it is today.
Well, it certainly is a disaster, and in fact, what we're going to do in the future is we're going to do a program specifically designed to explain to our audience what apartheid actually was, its history, and we're also going to have our audience explain to them what exactly the Rhodesian political system was, because unfortunately, Peter, we live in a world where Leon Trotsky's axiom, if you have an epithet, why think, applies. So if you just keep repeating the same epithet, white minority rule, that's all people have to know. They don't have to really understand what the situation was and does that really apply. And unfortunately, the West sold out to allies, and South Africa was sold out from within also. It turned out to be a very bad situation, and given what we have today, you know, hindsight is great. To me, it was a terrible mistake.
Well, certainly Rhodesia, you know, was different. It fought really to the last. I mean, it had the world really up against it, you know, completely. But anyway, of course, eventually it had to give way. It only had a population of whites of 300,000. And, you know, as I said, there wasn't apartheid. The idea originally was to have a partnership rule and have, you know, rule by civilized people. But of course, the world didn't want that. They wanted the country handed over to blacks immediately. And of course, the blacks that they wanted it handed over to were Marxists. You know, that's run by Robert Mugabe. No matter how much the Rhodesians protested about it, well, it didn't make any difference. That was what the world wanted. They wanted to hand over Mugabe. And of course, you know, the as they say, you know, people that sow the wind reap the whirlwind.
That's right. And they have yet to admit their mistake. Why was 1969, why did they begin in 1969? Was there any incident that created the need for these special forces?
Well, you know, there was a war sort of building up gradually on the borders of South Africa, particularly in Portuguese territories joining South Africa. That was Mozambique and Angola. They were having a rising insurgency warfare. And, you know, South Africa was looking on those countries with alarm, because if they fell, you know, then it was a sort of domino effect. In fact, that was the domino effect if Rhodesia fell as well. But at that particular time, you know, the weak points seemed to be the Portuguese territories, Angola and Mozambique. So it's really a sort of precautionary measure. And because they'd seen how effective the Rhodesian Special Forces, which was the Special Air Service and the Zulu Scouts, they'd seen how effective they were. And the necessity of having special forces for the South Africans arose from that, as it has with virtually every country in the world.
Now, from what I understand, the Zulu Scouts was so effective that basically the war was a stalemate as far as that went. It was that it was mainly political and economic pressure that forced the government to turn it over.
Well, of course, you know, the Zulu Scouts fought a pseudo-war. In other words, the idea was that you were fighting an enemy who was disguised. He wasn't wearing uniform. He could be anybody, the sort of person you passed in the street or the person that was living in the crawls. You didn't know who the enemy was. And so the idea of the Zulu Scouts was to have people pretending to be the enemy and infiltrating the enemy circles. And anyway, they brought, you could say that the Zulu Scouts were responsible for probably 96% of all the terrorists accounted for during the Rhodesian War. That didn't mean to say that they killed them all. What it meant was that they infiltrated the circles and led other forces in to do the contact. That was mainly what happened.
Was there a cross-border cooperation between the South African government and the government in Rhodesia in the training of South African commandos at the beginning?
Not in the beginning, no. The government was, the government of South Africa itself, you know, had different views than the military. The military could see the necessity, but the government couldn't see the necessity. And so the original cooperation between Rhodesian Special Forces and South African Special Forces for training purposes was done really covertly without the South African government knowing.
Oh, boy. Was there any cooperation with the CIA? Because prior to the United States buildup in Vietnam in 1965, actually the United States government had its special forces fighting the war over there, and it was quite successful. The problem became when the army decided that it didn't want counterinsurgency to be the main theater of operations, and then they started flooding the country with regular troops. So did they pick up any counterinsurgency help from the CIA or from the Green Berets?
Well, let's put it this way. generally your conventional forces and the conventional generals are never very happy about the formation of special forces. And the main reason why is because they generally didn't, I wouldn't say they don't now, but they didn't sort of see the necessity for special forces, and it also milked their units of the best men. The best men, of course, volunteered for special forces. But I would say this, that in Rhodesia, certainly, there were a lot of ex-US special forces who came over and joined the fight, because they thought they'd been fighting communism in Vietnam, and they were very sort of disappointed at the eventual result. So a lot of them just came to continue the fight in South Africa, and Rhodesia and South Africa, and they came to fight in both theaters of war.
Now, the major operations were in Angola, Mozambique, and in Sud-West Africa. It seems that the Portuguese colonies were really, from what I understand, the Portuguese literally left very little infrastructure, and they mainly didn't build any infrastructure or any political infrastructure in those countries, and that's why the guerrillas were able to operate so freely. Is that correct?
Well, I think that is completely true. I mean, if you come to Mozambique, you know, the Portuguese have been occupying Mozambique or colonizing at Mozambique for something like 400 years. And yet, you know, there was only two railways, main railways in Mozambique. One led from what was then Salisbury to Beira, and that was built by the Rhodesians, and the other one led from Johannesburg to what was Lorenzo Marx, and that was built by the South Africans. So there was a bit of a sort of laissez-faire attitude as far as these things are concerned. The sort of towns were policed, but the Portuguese attitude was to let the countryside get on with itself, and they didn't really care what happened in the countryside, and of course that was eventually their downfall.
Yes, the Marxists and Soviet-funded, I wouldn't even call them guerrillas, I just call them what they were, terrorists, found a vacuum to fill. And look, you know, the people really had no great love for the Portuguese. King Leopold basically decimated the Congo. The brutality was incredible. So
there was
no. Now, special operations, when they went into these countries, did they try to establish any type of relations with the populace, like as the Green Berets did? The Green Berets went in really, as a lot of it was done as teachers, and they were able to recruit, such as in Laos, from the Hmong tribesmen. They took various ethnic groups in the areas of Southeast Asia that they were in and befriended them, and they fought on the side of the U.S. Was that part of the role of the Ricci operations?
Oh, it certainly was, yes. In fact, you know, this was the original raison d'etre of special forces in World War II. I mean, they supported partisans in all sorts of Eastern Europe, particularly Yugoslavia and places like that, and very successfully. And so that was always considered to be necessity. In Mozambique, you had the guerrilla movement at RENAMU, which was established after the Portuguese handed over to Frelimo, you know, the communist movement. And that was very successfully fighting for Frelimo. And then when Rhodesia fell, the South Africans took over RENAMU as well. And that they continued that as a very successful fight right up till the end. In Angola, of course, you had a different situation. I mean, the Portuguese very arbitrarily pulled out in 1975. And there'd been three guerrilla movements fighting the Portuguese. not very successfully, I might add, but they'd been fighting them. And so when the Portuguese pulled out, you had three guerrilla movements, armed guerrilla movements there, and they began fighting each other for control, which was at that stage when, first of all, the CIA decided to back the FNLA and the UNITA movement, and they asked the South Africans to come in and assist, which they did. And this was to fight the remaining movement, which was the MPLA, which was backed by the Soviets and by Cuba. In fact, Cuba was supplying troops to back them up. So yes, indeed, this was happening. And unfortunately, the situation in Angola fell to pieces when the U.S. government decided that they were going to pull out, that the CIA, they stopped, the Senate stopped, the Congress stopped the funds for the CIA to back UNITA and the FNLA, and they pulled out, which left the South Africans to do it alone. Anyway, the South Africans had no option but to pull out at the time. But, the amount of money that the CIA had invested in Angola in this particular war was something like $35 million. The South Africans put in something more like $280 million. But anyway, they pulled out. But they went back in afterwards to keep the SWAPU movement, which was trying to infiltrate Angola, infiltrate Namibia, or Southwest Africa, it was called. And they went in to keep them back from the border.
Now, Angola, and we continually do programs on what I call the Boer-Cuban War in Angola, because basically that's what it had become. It's really never told in the West, or it's told strictly through the lens of Cuban propaganda, that there were 50,000, I call them Cuban mercenaries, and that's what they were. Castro, could you imagine a country the size of Cuba sending 50,000 troops to fight it in Africa? This lying, murdering, and it's a crime family that they've got been running Cuba for 50 years, Peter. This murdering son of a bitch has a monument in Cuba. It's not well known. It's not a big monument, but they call it, to those who did their internationalist duty. No, he was nothing more than a prostitute who pimped Cuban boys to go fight in Angola. I mean, they talk about Vietnam being a war that we had no part in. They had no damn right to be in Angola. And I took in graduate school, I took Latin American history, and not to digress too much, but it's interesting to understand the mind of the left over here. And the professor who was a staunch Marxist, and I fought this bastard every class, one of my classmates who was a teacher, and she was taking her graduate course, she really got him one night. She said to him, how is it that a country as size of Cuba with their economy can afford to send 50,000 troops to Angola? But this was in the mid-70s. I was in graduate school. And she said, couldn't that money be better used at home? And she just turned the argument that the left over here always used about U.S. foreign involvement. And he had the troops that were killed buried over there. Those who died of AIDS were buried over there. And eventually his top general, Ochoa, was executed, I believe it was 1980 or 81, in a Stalin show trial. General Ochoa, who bravely went to the gala of firing squad saying, Viva la Revolucion, Viva Castro. You know, you have to be a goddamn moron to believe that that's actually what happened. He did not want Ochoa to come back because Ochoa had such loyalty to his troops. He had set up a state within a state, and he was actually afraid he would lead a military coup against him and his brother.
Well, of course, this was true. I mean, nobody knew the casualties that the Cubans suffered. There's a lot of negative propaganda, which suggests that at battles like Cuito Cunaval, the South Africans lost 2,000 troops or something like that, which is absolute nonsense. You know, the South Africans couldn't have lost 2,000 troops because this is an open country. It was never a communist country. There might have been things wrong with its government, but the one thing they couldn't do was to cover up 2,000 deaths. Every sort of death was notified. It was in the newspapers, you know, in memoriam and so forth. And the number that was killed was relatively few. In fact, from the whole time of about from when the border wars started from 1962 until the end of the things in 1994, there was 2,000 killed, but that included people killed in motor accidents and sickness while killed on service and so forth like that. Whereas the Cubans in their time there, they had 2,500 killed in action. Now, I never knew this, but there's been an establishment in Pretoria, the capital of South Africa, of what is known as a Freedom Park, and it commemorates everybody who died for freedom. Now, that doesn't include any people that fought in the old SADF. What it does include is all the sort of guerrilla movements and the Cubans, and there are 2,500 names commemorated there. So they lost a lot of people in their particular war.
You know, Angola is such a fascinating aspect because it's never been really retold in the West. And for that matter, I don't know how much insight to Africa. But I do know that it was fascinating in as much as that at the beginning it became a locus of three powers fighting their own ideological differences and using Angola as a stage. You had the Chinese backing the FALN, and they were poorly backed. You had the U.S. backing the Union for the Total Independence of Angola, UNITA, and Dr. Zavimbi. And then you had the Soviets and the Cubans backing the MPLA. So here you had, on the world stage, this country became a focus of ideological and surrogate military battles between these three powers.
And it's true. I mean, the Soviets supplied the MPLA over the years with billions, and I mean literally billions of dollars worth of military equipment. And most of this was put in to build up an offensive to sort of drive the South Africans out of Angola. And inevitably, it ended up with billions of dollars worth of Soviet equipment being crashed. And I might tell you as well, the Soviets supplied their finest generals to lead these things. And in each case, the generals were actually completely discredited because they didn't know what they're doing. You know, I mean, the Soviets were looked on as a major threat in the West. And yet, while it was a so-called Cold War there, in Africa and in Asia, it was a hot war. And generally, where the Soviets were involved, they had their asses kicked good and solid. And, you know, I mean, their training was just something that's so out of date. You know, it was virtually almost like Waterloo training, where people sort of formed up and marched into battle. And, you know, where the generals and the officers could keep control of them. And of course, where the Soviets were involved, there weren't lots of Soviet troops involved. There were Soviet officers, but of course, they put that sort of training on the MPLA and so forth. And so that's why the MPLA suffered enormous casualties from the Soviet training. And I've always said that if the Cold War had erupted and they'd come across the border into Western Germany, people always feared this, but I think they'd have been cleaned up good and solid.
I agree. There was a book written, I forget by who the British colonel was. I had it and then I got rid of it. Unfortunately, it was World War III, and he had described that. In fact, in the book World War III, which was written back in the early 80s, he had described the Soviet invasion of Rhodesia and South Africa, and he said that there would have been volunteers from all over the Commonwealth to fight on their side against the Soviet troops. And, you know, the funny thing is they had a black radio station here in New York during the 80s that was vehemently, and I mean, or we could even say virulently, against Dr. Zavimbi and UNITA because of his alliance with South Africa, and yet they were mentioning the amount, in talking about it, I remember phoning in and saying you should get your facts straight. The UNITA received $80 million in aid, this was sometime during the 80s, from the United States, whereas the MPLA received over $800 million in aid from the Soviet Union. And, of course, the host, who was caught red with his pants down, said, well, I don't know about that. I said, well, if you don't know about that, then don't talk about the topic.
Yeah, well, I think, actually, in the end, you know, the records are probably in Moscow, but I can tell you it was a lot more than $800 million worth of aid that the MPLA got. It was really enormous amount of aid, jet fighters, helicopters, tanks, you know, it was just enormous amount of aid. And, of course, it was knocked out. In fact, I think you see there's a photograph in the book there of a whole line of transports that were supplied by the Soviets knocked out.
Now, and the irony of this whole thing is, they were condemning the apartheid system. And you have to remember, such is the nature of propaganda, that you can always put across any point that you want since you control it. But the fact is, I mean, back in the 60s, the Soviets had propaganda of slums in America and said, especially with a captive audience, this is the American system, look at how the Americans live. So you could always focus on a narrow negative and make that seem as the whole. And really that was done with South Africa. There were many positives at that point. And you know, Peter, this was Leninism. Just destroy the system. In Leninism, there's no such thing as working within the system and changing the system and you have a viability. Here it was the communists of just destroy it. But I want to get on to the training. How were those picked for special forces? Did they volunteer? And what was the training like?
Well, the special forces, they were all volunteers. And the selection for it, you know, of the people that went through the selection courses, probably only 2% got through. They were the absolute tops, elite of the elite. And that applies to blacks as well as white, because the special forces in South Africa, and Rhodesia for that matter, weren't just whites, they were blacks. Because, you know, that's what a lot of people think. They think it was just whites fighting blacks. It wasn't. It was people fighting communism, and that included blacks fighting communism. But that's very conveniently overlooked. But the training they went through was very, very extensive, because the 2% that passed were then put through an enormous amount of training. Now, you know, when you think of the U.S. Special Forces or even the British Special Forces, you know, the SAS, they always have somebody in support of them. There's always Air Force on call if necessary to sort of do a strike and help them out. Now, the South Africans particularly, they sort of operated sometimes 1,000 miles away from nearest base. And if things went wrong, they had to get out by themselves. And a lot of them did. And I know some particular instances where they only got out through a desert area, literally, by drinking their own urine.
My goodness. Now, when they were sent in on an operation, well, is it like specific instances that you can relate to the audience of how tough the training was, what a training, daily training regiment was like, were they given, what kind of assignments they were given in their training?
Well, of course, you know, I mean, one particular tough one was during the latter stages of the Angolan War, where you had Cuito Cunaval, which was a place where the enemy, which was the Soviet-backed MPLA, plus the Cubans, were backing up forces, and the Soviets were pouring in equipment. And the idea was that they were going to advance southeast to capture a place called Mavinga, where there was an airfield. Now, this airfield was very important because it was the airfield where the South Africans were flying in supplies to replenish the equipment of UNITA. Anyway, it was felt that they could sort of disrupt the transportation or the movement of supplies and troops if they blew up a very important bridge crossing the Cuito River, which was at Cuito Cunaval. And a special forces team of 12 men from 4 Recce, they were that was the waterborne unit of the special forces. They were dropped in 70 kilometers north of Cuito Cunaval, and they swam, and they went down first of all by raft, and then they swam the 70 kilometers to Cuito Cunaval with their explosives and so forth. And anyway, when they got there, the Angolan troops spotted somebody breaking the surface with his knapsack, and so they started firing on throwing grenades in the water. But nevertheless, these guys planted their bombs, their bombs with timers, and managed to swim through and get down. And then they swam another sort of something like another 50 kilometers downstream. And during the course of that, two of the members were attacked by crocodiles. And in each case, they fought off the crocodiles. They'd been trained for this sort of thing, which is a ghastly sort of thing to anticipate. And the idea was to stab the crocodiles in the eyes and in a soft spot in the neck. And anyway, they did this and managed to sort of, the crocodiles let them go. And they managed to continue on and get to the end of the swimming thing. And then they had to walk another 20 kilometers for a helicopter pickup point. I mean, those were the sort of stressful sort of operations these guys went through.
You know, we have the triathlon. I'm pretty sure they probably have it in South Africa. And that's what it sounds like, that this was triathlon. And not
with
only
the crocodile
that...
thrown in.
Right. I mean, it's just incredible when you think of the abilities that these men had and that their story up until now, really, thanks to you, is finally
being
told.
Well, it just shows you the degree of training they had, you know, to deal with virtually anything that could happen, anything that anticipated they were trained for.
Now, in the book, you mentioned the Israelis. I believe the Israelis were really stunned at the fact that these men were sent in with no backup. Am I correct in that?
Yeah, that's right. And even Americans who came over to sort of see, because there were a lot of American U.S. officers who came over to see how the war was progressing and how it was being fought. This is the nature of things, you know. People, particularly in special forces, do come over and see, no matter whether the government approves or not. And they were absolutely astonished that there was no sort of immediate backup. So were the Israelis. But, of course, you must appreciate the Israeli special forces are brilliant, but they're operating over a very, very small area. And so bringing in backup is not difficult. But Africa is a vast area. And these guys were operating in areas, as I say, a thousand miles from their base.
You know, we interviewed Friday night another author, and her book is called An Unpopular War. And she had said that the war was condemned internationally. But I said, who cares who condemned it? I mean, well, who was condemning it internationally? The Soviets? The communists were condemning it? If they condemned it, then that must have meant that the South Africans were quite just in their cause against fighting against them.
Well, of course, the lady that wrote Unpopular War, you know, which is a very good book, but, you know, she was writing it from a national service perspective, you know, a conscripts. And you will appreciate that in a regular force, there is nobody who's reluctant, because if they were reluctant, they wouldn't have joined. But when you're dealing with conscripts, you know, although most aren't reluctant, you always find people that are reluctant and wish they hadn't been called up. And so, you know, that book, actually, although a very good book, it highlights those points of the people who were reluctant to fight. You know, the average young man is quite happy to go and fight, as whether it's Americans, South Africans, Brits, or whoever they are. They're all actually quite willing to go and do their thing for their country.
Now, when they also fought along the south border of Southwest Africa against SWAPO, how did they fare against the SWAPO forces?
Well, you'll be getting another book. It's in the mail to you, called The Covert War, which particularly deals with a unit called KUFU, which is Afrikaans for crowbar. And this was a police counterinsurgency unit. And they fought SWAPO inside the country. And they were highly successful. But, of course, they suffered the penalty for it. Although they killed more SWAPO than any other unit, including the reconnaissance commandos, they also suffered more casualties than any other South African unit since World War II. But, you know, their particular modus operandi was unique, but you'll see that in the book, so it's best not to go through that now.
All right. What was daily regimen like in training?
Sorry?
What are some of the assignments? What was the daily regimen like in training? What type of training assignments would they have been given?
Well, it's really like all sort of special forces. You know, it's not just training in the sense of military training of, you know, firing rifles and doing all that sort of stuff and keeping fit. It was also something where, you know, they were sort of highly educated. You know, they studied communism. They studied all this sort of stuff. They studied what guerrilla wars. They studied Che Guevara, all those sort of things. So, you know, they knew what they were sort of doing. In fact, special forces recruits anywhere in the world are people well above average of the average person in intelligence. And, you know, those sort of guys are, wherever they are, in the U.S. or wherever, those sort of guys are well prepared to tackle anything. And I think the sort of training they were given are given anywhere in the world is much the same as the reconnaissance commandos. But the only difference with the Silent War is that it's the first time ever that a full book has been written going A to Z of special operations, because all these things were absolutely top secret. It's only that after the fall of apartheid and when the ANC came to power that I was able to publish this. Originally, I'd been forbidden to publish it. I'd researched it, but then I was forbidden on penalty of imprisonment of publishing this. So, you know, that's the whole sort of trick about it, you know.
You know, you mentioned Che Guevara, who unfortunately, and we've done a few shows with Cuban Americans on Che Guevara. You know, he's been become a folk hero among the ignorant here.
Of course,
T-shirts,
yeah.
T-shirts, you know, and such and the like, and bumper stickers on cars, and even some art museum in New York has done a show on him, which caused quite an uproar because the man was a brutal murderer. And
of course
the thing
he was.
Is that, you know, yes, and the thing is, the Cubans were quite active at one time here in South America and Latin America in given...
In Colombia, Venezuela, isn't it?
Excuse me?
I say in Colombia and Venezuela in particular.
Yes, yes, and they were counter-insurgency, and there was this myth that had grown about how great their forces were. But in your book, you really show how they ran up against a stone wall when they took on the Riki operations.
Well, they did, yes. I mean, that was exactly it. You know, I mean, it seems easy, you know, for these sort of guerrillas to go in and create havoc, which, of course, they do. But when they're against special, you know, very well-trained special forces who can hunt them down, then, of course, they don't really stand a chance. I mean, you know, the South Africans in particular were absolutely expert at tracking. And this, they learnt, you know, they could track people across solid sort of rock, more or less. Tricks they learnt from Bushmen and various tribes in Namibia who were absolutely expert in this sort of stuff.
And plus, the Boers themselves are African, which is never really understood here in the West. I mean, I've met people who
of course
couldn't believe.
The truth is, of course, that South Africa didn't only comprise of the Boers. You know, there were English-speaking South Africans as well, and in all these sort of units, there were English speakers and volunteers. You know, there were Americans there as well. And a lot of Rhodesians, because after the fall of Rhodesia, you know, a lot came down and joined South African Special Forces. And of course,
you know,
Rhodesia was English-speaking completely.
That's right. And, of course, and speaking of a white, or so-called white minority government in Rhodesia, they always fail to mention that Joshua Nkomo, when he was being threatened by Robert the Murderer Mugabe, fled for refuge in South Africa. that contradiction they never want to talk about.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
So, you know, it's quite misunderstood here in the West, and I think that's why your book is so valuable, because it's always depicted as the white South African government had invaded it, when in fact, they were merely helping those who wanted to ensure their own freedom. And unfortunately, due to the stupidity and political machinations, intrigues here in the West, the situation was just nothing more than a terrible sellout due to, the United States policy, and I'm speaking strictly about the United States, not Great Britain, is based on domestic considerations. And there was a lot of domestic pressure on the politicians here to abandon our allies over there rather than allow them to solve their problems their own way.
Of course, this was true. I mean, that happened after the sort of Portuguese pullout in 1975. But then, of course, when Ronald Reagan came into power in America, things changed. And Ronald Reagan, I've always believed, was the man who cracked communist power. He's the man that broke the Soviets. And the only weird reason he broke the Soviets, because he showed that he wasn't afraid of them. Every time they threatened something, he upped the ante. It was like a game of poker. And eventually, the Soviets had to throw in their hand because they didn't have enough money to continue.
You know, we can talk about 1975. With the advent of the election of Jimmy Carter in 1976,
well, that's where that's where everything went wrong, you know.
Yes, yes. The Soviets were on the march. It really looked like it was their destiny here in the United States. The Caribbean had become a Soviet Mare Nostrum. Their pocket battleship, the Kirov, was docking in Moscow and Nicaragua. They truly were. They had allies in Grenada. They were basically trying to Finlandize the United States. And Carter was sounding retreat. I'll give you an example what a disaster this man is and how he has never ever learned the lessons of history. He wrote an article in the New York Times a few months ago about the United States and Iraq. And then he mentioned in his political solution, he mentioned how the Maoists in Nepal had been brought into the government, you know, because even though they're communists, they can be dealt with and they can become part of the system. Remember, Mao was the greatest mass murderer in history. Well, it turns out that the Maoists in Nepal had pulled out of the government because they didn't win the majority. So this is another example of the short-sightedness and, I dare say, utter stupidity of this man.
And
he
ignorance.
Lives in a total... Excuse me?
And ignorance.
Yes, yes.
Absolute ignorance of the purpose of what the communists were about.
Yes, he lives in a totally different dimension than the rest of us. He just feels he's above it, he's superior, he's spiritual, and in fact, he's just an ignoramus when it comes to world affairs. Now, let me go on. What was going on internally? Oh, I just want to say this. The propaganda war that was being waged also, for example, Guido Carnaval, they had said that the Cubans had said, and I remember following or whatever was coming out at that time, Cubans had said that they won the battle and that South Africa had broke its teeth on the iron edge of Guido Carnaval. Is there any truth to that?
No, not at all. Not at all. In fact, you could say that, you know, the Battle of Guido Carnaval ended up as a stalemate. But the South Africans, really, they had no purpose in capturing Guido Carnaval. It wasn't anything. If they'd captured Guido Carnaval, they would still face the hinterland of Angola. And they never had any intention of capturing the whole of Angola, or occupying it. Because if they had, you know, it would have been, you could say it would have become their Saigon. And so they certainly didn't want that. And the one thing I will say about the Soviets, the Cubans, the East Germans, the one thing they were very, very good at fighting was a propaganda war. And when they fought it, they won every time. In fact, I think they generally won throughout the Cold War. Every time they brought out propaganda, they seemed to win. Whereas, you know, the West was basing their things on honesty. And honesty doesn't really stand up to when you have somebody that's doing double dealing.
Well, we interviewed on Right Perspective General Magnus Malan.
Oh, yes.
And he said that there was no defeat. He said, in fact, there was no major battle there. He said it had to do with a bridge at Guido Carnaval.
Well, no, there was several major battles there. There were several major battles there, but, you know, it wasn't anything where the South Africans suffered enormous casualties. They didn't.
Well, they keep saying it here on the left that this was this Cuban victory. And from what I understand, the Cubans were very bad fighters in the bush. Is that true?
Well, they weren't very good fighters per se. You know, their casualties sort of proved that. As I say, there was 2,500 casualties, deaths that their names are on a monument in this Freedom Park in Pretoria. But, you know, the thing is that generally one reckons that for every man that's killed, there's another 10 who are wounded. Now, that's not so much now where people can wear body armor, but none of the Cubans had body armor. So for the 2,500 dead, they had 25,000 casualties. And, of course, with those sort of casualties in war, it's not simple little bullet holes through the arm like it is in cowboy stories. You know, it's men who lost limbs and blind and so forth, you know.
Correct, that's right. I believe they were able to also do so well in the propaganda war, because the government in South Africa was not particularly sophisticated. There was a lot of double dealing with the Bruderbund, For example, I have read a book on the called the Matryoshkin Archives, the Secret Files of the KGB, and it turns out that the diamond company down there was selling industrial diamonds worth R1 billion to the Soviets at the time that they were fighting in Angola.
Yeah. All these funny things happen, you know, particularly when there's no declared war. And nowadays, of course, there's never a declared war.
That's right. So here they're fighting them, and the government knew about this, but the government didn't stop them. You know, they were bringing money into the country from the Soviets who they were fighting in Angola. I mean, it was crazy. It just shows you that there was a disconnect between what was going on over there and the reality of the situation. And that's what I wanted
to... I can give you a good example of these funny things that happen in these sort of wars. I mean, after Reagan came to power and the CIA became connected with supporting UNITA, U.S. oil companies were still drilling for oil and taking out oil from the Angolan oil wells off their coast. I mean, they were running Angola's economy, and the economy was busy fighting UNITA, which the U.S. was supporting. It's a bit of a contradiction in terms, isn't it?
Well, that's why I had said that at the time there was not going to be any World War III, because if the Soviets attacked the United States, who would they buy their wheat from? You know, here we are talking about the Soviet threat, but we're feeding them at the same time. So in many respects, we're all made dupes of the government. And also, the propaganda in Angola, for example, the New York Times, which is called the paper of record here in the United States, ran a story that Jamba, the provisional capital of UNITA, had been overrun by Cuban troops. And there was an individual, Lou Lerman, who owned a string of drug stores here in New York State, who had gone to Angola. He had run for governor, and he was a conservative, and he had gone to Angola. And by the way, he had been the victim of vicious campaign of lies against him at that time from the left here in New York State. He went to Angola, and he wrote a column in the New York Post saying, and this was 2 weeks later, saying, I was sitting in the longhouse, and we were with Dr. Zavimbi. They were singing songs. He said Jamba was an overrun, yet here this propaganda piece was run in the New York Times as fact, when it was a pure fiction of the Cubans.
Yeah. What do you say the New York Times is called?
Excuse me?
You said that the New York Times has a particular name in America.
It has... It's called the paper of record. It's supposed to be the most impeccable source of news.
Well, there you are. It's not necessarily a record, is it?
No, not at all. And I've said this before. I have stamps that were printed in South Africa for UNITA. They're called provisionals because they're not recognized by the Universal Postal Union as,
of course,
legitimate stamps, but they were used in UNITA-controlled areas, and there's a quote in Portuguese from Dr. Zavimbi, that the late, great Dr. Zavimbi, that translates from his sayings. And I think in South Africa, the Boers should remember it. There are no weapons in the world with the capacity to forever stop the will of the people.
And well, that's, of course,
we know Dr. Zavimbi was ambushed because of the oil deals that they wanted in Angola. Let me ask you. I've been told by veterans that we've interviewed on the program that they had surrounded Luanda, that the SADF was ready to go in and take Luanda, and they were suddenly called back. Now, do you know the reason why that happened?
Well, of course, what had happened is they were within about 20 kilometers of Luanda, and they couldn't get there because the Cubans had blown all the river bridges, and it was in the rainy season, so the rivers were in spate. But the strange thing about it was that I've discovered that the South Africans had bridging equipment. They had bridging equipment in South Africa, but they didn't send it to the front, so I don't know why.
Well, that leads up to the next question, and that's why the book is so really, really interesting, because you really meticulously researched it, and you brought to light facets of what was going on that hitherto completely unknown to us in the West. What was going on with President of John Foster at that time and his negotiations, I believe, was was it Zambia and how he was putting pressure on Rhodesia?
Well, you see, he was vacillating all the time. You must appreciate that in World War II, John Foster was a member of what was known as the OBs, the Ossifar Brumvat. It was a sort of ox wagon thing, you know, going back to the times of the Great Trek in the 19th century. And they were pro-Nazi. And while South Africa fought on the Allied side, they fought in North Africa and in Italy. Internally, they were having sabotage by the OBs, and John Foster was one of those who was actually detained for the duration of the war. But later, of course, he became Prime Minister. Such is the way of history.
Well, we had interviewed H.S. von Blech, who is still alive. He's 90-something years old, and he's a member of the...
What's name you say?
H.S. von Blech.
I don't know him.
Yeah, he's 90-something years old. He was at the Majuba Day celebration, and he was a member of the Ossifar Brumvat. But weren't members of the Ossifar Brumvat pro-German because of the animosity left over from the Boer War and the treatment that the Boers received by the British?
Well, you could say that, yes. They were defeated and they had a lasting animosity about it. A lot of them still do.
Excuse me?
I'd say, they were left with a lasting animosity against the British, and a lot of them still have this lasting animosity against anything sort of English. But the majority don't. But there are that sort of minority that still do. You know, the funny thing is, you know, as I say, I'm British by birth. And when I came to Southern Africa, you know, the last war in my mind was the Second World War. And before that, you know, after that you had the Korean War. In fact, there were so many wars that the Brits were involved in that I found it quite astonishing that people were still remembering the Boer War, which had happened so many years before. But, of course, in South Africa, perhaps, it was more personal.
That's really, I think, quite correct and quite true. So Foster was negotiating. Now, you write about, I believe it was he went into Zambia, and what they did was they had... they set up a scene where people would be cheering him, but he didn't know in his naivete and I guess in his arrogance, that egotism, that this was a fraud, that they just set these people up to cheer for him. They were just, I guess what you could say, a hired crowd.
Well, they were rented crowd, yeah. I mean, you know, it was absolutely ridiculous. And, I mean, in his own sort of biography, you know, he sort of wrote quite proudly about these people, but it was so obviously a renter crowd. It was unbelievable that he could think otherwise.
And who was the Who was the individual with the pet lion on a leash that was there?
Oh, well, no, that was Jan Breitenbach, who was the founder of the Reckies. You know, he was the man who had a pet lion, and the pet lion was sort of roamed freely at Dobby's, which was their training base or forward base in the Caprivi Strip.
Now, did Vorster believe that he could negotiate with these nations and they would accept South Africa's national government? Was he deluded
in that? Yeah, that's exactly what happened. He negotiated with President Kaunda, who'd been voted as president for life of Zambia. You know, that was the way. He's no longer there, but he's still alive, so he's lucky. But anyway, with the negotiations that Vorster had with President Kaunda, which was done, you know, through go-betweens, I mean, Kaunda said, look, if you sort of ditch Rhodesia and, you know, go against Rhodesia, stop helping them, then we'll recognize the South African apartheid government because we realize you're just another white tribe. You're just another tribe of Africa, albeit a white tribe. But, of course, this was absolute bloody nonsense, but Vorster believed it. And so that's when he stopped helping Rhodesia.
Oh, you see, I've always wondered, and I've gotten many emails from listeners to The Right Perspective as to why South Africa wind up pulling out its support for Rhodesia. So he really believed in his own hubris that he could negotiate with them and they would accept the Nash. He was quite naive, quite naive. It's unbelievable.
So, well, of course, you see, what Kaunda did is he said to Vorster, through go-betweens, that if he stopped supporting Rhodesia, which was, of course, very important because Rhodesia was a landlocked country, if he stopped supporting Rhodesia, then Black Africa, the frontline states, would recognize the apartheid government, except they didn't call it the apartheid government. What they said is, look, you know, the South Africans, or the Boers, if you like to call them that, you know, they are another tribe of Africa. They may be white, but they're a tribe of Africa. They're just like us. So we've got no quarrel against them. Just stop supporting, you know, the Rhodesians. But, of course, this was absolute bullshit. You know, because, of course, they had no intention of allowing apartheid to continue in South Africa. So that's really one of the things that triggered Vorster into selling Rhodesia out.
You know, it's, and I've often said this, that unfortunately the South Africans were they were isolated and not really worldly. They just couldn't understand the nature of the situation in the broader context. And it was almost, provincialism to think.
It was. They were very isolated. They felt that they should be left alone to continue their way of life as they'd always done, and they wouldn't interfere with anybody, and then nobody should interfere with them. But, of course, that's not the way of the world.
No, they were caught up in a geopolitical strategy. The Soviets at that time saw the Cape as a choke, and it was considered a choke point of international traffic.
It was.
The Soviets desperately wanted that control. I remember they'd have on talk programs here in New York, they'd have South African diplomats come on and try to explain the situation over there, the language, a variety of languages and tribes and cultures, and it didn't go off because the opposition had such hatred to them. They were just focused on apartheid and that one facet, and they were not going to listen to anything else, and they wanted to see the destruction of that system. And you have to remember, that system was basically no different than what the United States had in the 1940s and 50s. And using their reasoning, should we have destroyed the United States government? Should we have turned our society upside down? But the unfortunate part is that here you had 4.5 million people. You know, the United States was a world power. And so they were isolated, naive. I mean, I wanted to go there back in 81. And I went up to the consulate to get my passport. And they were very nasty to me up there. I mean, I met somebody up there working behind the bulletproof glass. And she was very nasty. She made a very nasty remark to me and made me feel very unwelcome that if I went there. Of course, that's not how the people are. But there was a certain
hostility.
Excuse me?
Certain hostility.
Yes, yes. And, you know, I mean, at that time, you certainly need all the friends they had. I had met a boer in New York City and gave me his business card and said, you know, come and visit us. It's, you know, but the... The diplomats up there, the consulate, weren't like that. I mean, I remember they had a travel office up there, and I went there, and I said, you know, I don't have a car. Of course, I didn't need a car, but I didn't know that, you know, because I didn't know about the transportation system back at that time. And I said, you know, do I need a car? And she said, yes, you know, if you can't drive, you know, maybe you shouldn't come there. And they were doing everything to discourage me, and I was really wondering at that time, like, why are they being like this? But that isolation and provincialism in dealing with the wider context of international politics is what brought about that defeat, that sellout, because basically they should have said, look, we're going to hunker down, and we're going to take what we have to keep our country, you know. And unfortunately, also, they didn't have patrons such as the Israelis did with the United States. So they were alone and isolated, and 4.5 million people just, unless you have like a North Korea and you have a Kim Il-sung who doesn't care how many of his people die as long as he keeps power. But it wasn't. It was a Christian nation, and it had a morality, and unfortunately, their political overview of the world didn't belong with what the reality was.
Well, of course, you see, I mean, when Portuguese pulled out of Angola, the Soviets saw this as a golden opportunity, because the idea was if they could control Angola through surrogates, then they were convinced they could control Southwest Africa and Namibia through surrogates. And by then, you know, they would be in the soft underbelly of South Africa and take over South Africa, also through surrogates. And so they would control the Cape Sea route, which, as you said, was a choke point. It certainly was. It still is a choke point. Because, you know, if you can't get through the Suez area, then the only other way around is through the Cape. And if you control the Cape, particularly nowadays with long-range weapons, nothing can get through unless you allow it.
Now, let me ask you, Peter, looking back on this, the extraordinary actions, the sacrifice these men made, in the end, was it worth it?
Well, I think it probably was, because if they had collapsed earlier, then I think, you know, maybe the Soviets wouldn't have collapsed.
Right.
You know, it was really Southern Africa, the Rhodesians and the South Africans, that showed the South Africans could be defeated. And they did defeat them time and time again. I mean, the Rhodesians were the first ones to do it. And, you know, they had Soviet advisors advising the various so-called liberation parties in Zambia, and the Rhodesians kicked the hell out of them. And then, of course, when it transferred to Angola, the South Africans did the same. And then when they sent in top Soviet generals to command the various sort of surrogate armies, they had their asses kicked as well. And, you know, the Soviets suffered major defeats, which, of course, they don't want to talk about now, even nowadays, because I think the same thing would apply. Maybe the Russians are flexing their muscles with Georgia, but, you know, Georgia's a very small country. And, you know, they couldn't really flex their muscles against anybody more powerful, because they would really sort of see their butts.
Well, I know that the Russians paid a heavy price to pacify Chechnya, and I would like to see, I want to see if the world is going to condemn them now in Georgia the way they condemned South Africa and Angola. This is an atrocity, what they've done in Georgia, bombing the capital, Tbilisi, bombing the airports. I mean, Putin wants to reassert Russian imperialism, and it's so true that the unwritten chapter about South Africa's contribution, because history is being written with the leftist slant, and thank goodness we have books like yours, which show that their sacrifice did help bring down the Soviet Union, and it's unknown in the West how these magnificent heroes truly brought destroyed the myth of Soviet invincibility. The Soviets were very good at fighting massive battles in the East when they fought the Nazis. You know, they have a Russian saying, if all you have is a hammer, then treat everything like a nail. And that was proven in Afghanistan also, that their army could not adapt. They don't have an adaptability. And here, the South Africa, the SADF, were Africans. I mean, they knew the land, they were brought up with the land, and they knew how to fight that type of counterinsurgency.
And they were tremendously adaptable.
That's the key to fighting a counterinsurgency war, because all we saw in the 1970s were heard about were the wars of liberation. And that's a final question, Peter. In 1989, communism collapsed. Why was the country sold out to communists in 1994? Becky was trained in Moscow by the KGB. I mean, how does that make him qualified to lead a country? Why would you sell out a country to communists 5 years after its collapse and knowing what a failure it was?
Well, I think, you know, the biggest problem was economically. You know, the South Africans had put so much into the war that the country was, you could say, almost broke. It was a bit like Britain after the end of the Second World War. They were virtually broke. You know, the Marshall Plan was put in to help the sort of defeated countries get back on their feet. But, you know, there was no Marshall Plan for Britain. And, you know, I left Britain in 1951. And in 1951, there was still rationing in Britain, even though it was 5 years, 6 years after the war. Now, South Africa had nobody to sort of reestablish their economy. So I think eventually they were forced into this situation.
Well, you know, that's it. They weren't like Israel, where they had the patron of the United States giving them $3 billion a year.
No, they weren't.
You know, they were just left alone by the West, and there were those in the West who desperately wanted, who somehow felt, I believe, that it was a reflection on them to say, well, see, we're not racist. We're going to not help this government. We're not going to, you know, whatever indignities you had under apartheid, whatever I would call it mistakes you had compared to what you had in the rest of the world under communism. I mean, 1975, you had the genocide in Cambodia while they were condemning apartheid. You have in North Korea, you have a crime family that's been running that country that sells amphetamines, illegal weapons, counterfeiting, kidnapping. I mean, we have people in jail in America, you know, in the mafia that are in jail for this. And this bastard is still free. So
yeah,
they demonized it to the point of where it doesn't really touch reality.
No, well, you know, I mean, yeah, with the Soviets, of course, when you look at what the old Soviet Union, the extent of it, you know, how vast it was, eventually, you know, they had to lose control because, I mean, it stretched, you know, from Europe right the way almost to Japan. And, you know, just across the sea was Japan in the final peace of the Soviet Union. And I think personally that China is going to find the same problems. I mean, I was astonished to hear in the last couple of days, you know, these particular Muslim separatists in China who killed some policemen and all that sort of thing. I mean, that particular area is closer to Baghdad than it is to sort of Beijing.
That's right.
And the question of controlling it eventually becomes impossible.
That's right. But they've put apartheid on. I mean, they'll say, oh, we defeated Nazism, totalitarianism. They won't say communism. In fact, Bush compared communism to National Socialism, and Putin got very upset. But they'll put apartheid on a level that when you have 4.5 million people in a unique situation who could have worked the situation out, there's no reason that they eventually could have worked the situation out. And
you're quite right. They could have done. If they'd been left alone, they could have done it.
Would have been much different. Well, Peter, it's Peter Stiff. We want to thank you.
Only a pleasure.
Right to Spect, author of The Silent War, South African Riki Operations, 1969 to 1994. You can order the book online by going to the website www.galago.co.za. That's www.galago.co.za, GALAGO. And you'll be back with your two other books in the series that you've sent us. And we really, really appreciate you coming on. And we really look forward to speaking to you about this again.
That's certainly a pleasure. I've enjoyed speaking to you as well.
Thank you very much. Good seeing you.
Okay. Bye. Bye.